Okay, ready to dive deep today. Let's step back from the headlines for a bit.
Yeah, sounds good.
Today we're going way back, excavating the origins of fundamentalism.
Interesting.
And no, not like the hot button stuff we hear about now. We're talking early 20th century America.
Gotcha.
It's surprising, actually, how this movement, shaped by very specific things back then, still has these subtle echoes in our culture and even some of the ways we think.
Hmm. I can see that.
You asked for a deep dive into its roots, so buckle up. Here we go.
Let's do it. The material we're using comes from a church history lecture, really insightful, on 20th century American fundamentalism.
Okay.
And it doesn't just list facts and figures. It's about understanding the pressures, the ideas that actually made this movement happen.
Perfect. Our mission, as always, is to clear the fog for you.
Yeah.
We'll pull out those key factors, introduce you to the people who really shaped fundamentalism.
Right.
Consider this your crash course in a misunderstood period of American history. One that's still relevant, by the way.
Absolutely.
Okay, let's unpack this.
So to understand where it all began, the lecture starts with some big names.
Okay, makes sense.
First up, Dwight L. Moody, late 19th century, 1837 to 1899.
Okay.
Crucial transitional figure. Didn't quite make it to the 20th century.
Yeah.
But his influence was huge. Really set the stage for what was coming.
So Moody's like a catalyst, right?
You could say that.
The lecture points to three big contributions.
Oh.
First, tireless organizer. Basically brilliant at those evangelistic crusades he held.
Oh, yeah.
Not just filling seats, but actually building lasting churches and educational institutions.
That's a good point. What's so different about that approach, you know?
Well, think about it. Instead of these one-off revivals,
he's
creating permanent structures, churches, schools.
Right, right. And the fundamentalists would copy that later on.
Exactly. Creating their own institutions, their own systems.
Pretty clever. When you think about it.
The second thing about Moody, amazing pulpit person, like a truly gifted preacher.
Yeah.
But with this down-to-earth homey style that really connected with everyday people.
Makes sense.
Led to a lot of conversions and people getting much more involved in their churches.
So he spoke their language.
Totally. Made those ideas that would become fundamentalism.
Yeah.
Accessible, relatable.
Powerful stuff.
Third key thing, huge supporter of foreign missions. Like, driving force in the 19th century missionary movement.
So his faith wasn't just talk, it was action.
Exactly. Put his beliefs into practice on a global scale.
Wow.
And all three of these, the organizing, the preaching, the mission focus, fundamentalists would pick those up and run with them.
Really laid the groundwork.
Big time. Now, there's another guy the lecture talks about, Adoniram Judson Gordon.
Ah, yeah.
1836 to 1895.
Okay.
Lived around the same time as Moody. They were friends, actually. And this name might ring a bell for some listeners.
Maybe, yeah.
He founded Gordon College.
Oh, wow.
Started as the Boston Missionary Training School back in 1889.
Mm-hmm.
Goal was to train missionaries for the Congo.
Makes sense.
And get this. It all began in the basement of his church, Clarendon Street Church.
No kidding. That's amazing.
Humble beginnings for a pretty impactful institution.
Yeah, you don't see that every day.
So the lecture highlights six things about Gordon's ministry that really foreshadowed fundamentalism.
Okay, I'm intrigued.
First one, his belief in historical premillennialism.
Right.
Now, that's a whole other deep dive, theologically speaking.
Like this,
But it was central to how he saw the world, the future.
Gotcha.
But what's fascinating is how Gordon's own ministry had these elements that would become fundamentalist hallmarks.
You're right, yeah.
The lecture breaks it down into six things, like I said.
Okay.
Historical premillennialism being the first, like we talked about.
Right, which we won't go into detail now.
Whole other can of worms.
It's exactly.
And holiness. Now, this isn't about being perfect.
Right.
But more like a constant journey, becoming more Christ-like.
Growing, yeah.
The lecture calls it a pilgrimage.
I like that.
Faith as something you live, something that develops.
Not a destination, a journey.
Exactly. Third thing, Gordon had this careful understanding of worship.
Hmm.
Really emphasized public worship within the church.
So how you express your faith publicly matters.
Yeah, communal aspect of it. We won't get into his specific views on liturgy.
Right, right.
But it shows a concern for doing it the right way, you know?
Yeah, I get it. Structure and tradition.
Now, the fourth thing is really interesting.
Okay, lay it on me.
Belief in healing ministry.
Interesting.
But the lecture's clear he didn't think everyone would get miraculously healed.
Right.
More like healing could happen through God's providence.
So Not guaranteed, but possible.
Exactly. Not every prayer results in a miracle cure.
Yeah.
But the potential is there through divine intervention.
A complex intersection of faith and reality.
For sure. Fifth thing, Gordon really stressed ethics.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that good theology should lead to a good ethical life.
Right. Actions speak louder than words kind of thing.
Absolutely. Putting your beliefs into practice.
Yeah. Like one of his professors said, all good theology ends in ethics.
Love that. It's about how you live, how you treat others.
Right. The practical side of faith.
And last but not least, just like Moody,
okay,
Gordon had a strong interest in missions.
Fits right in with founding a missionary training school.
Makes perfect sense. Underscores that outward focus, spreading the faith.
Yeah.
It's really striking how much of Gordon's ministry,
it is, yeah,
these elements line up with what would become key concerns in fundamentalism.
It's like a preview, almost.
Totally. But to see the full picture,
right,
we can't just look at individuals. The lecture also points to some big societal shifts happening around them.
Oh, for sure. Context is everything.
Yeah, this is the 19th, early 20th century.
Big changes happening all over.
Big time. First major force, the rise of scientific investigation.
Ah, yeah.
The big one, of course, Darwin's Origin of Species, 1859.
Huge, yeah.
You can imagine a theory like evolution suggesting humans came from somewhere other than the biblical account.
Uh-huh.
Well, that shook things up a bit.
Definitely challenged some long-held beliefs.
Absolutely. A new way of understanding the world that didn't always fit with traditional interpretations.
Right. Made some people uneasy.
Second force, the rise of historical thinking.
Okay.
And this led to some pretty big challenges to established truths.
I can see that.
Including the historical accuracy of the Bible, even the existence of Jesus.
Whoa, that's a big deal.
Huge. Not just academic debates either.
No, I bet not.
This really shook the faith of many people.
Undermining the very foundations.
Exactly. And then building on that, you have biblical criticism.
Okay.
This was a much more intense scholarly look at the Bible itself.
Ah, so not just taking it at face value.
No, they're digging deep. Asking questions like, when were the different books written? Mm-hmm. Who actually wrote them?
Uh-huh.
And the lecture even says some of this got pretty extreme.
So what did that look like, this extreme criticism?
Well, they were applying historical and literary analysis to the Bible.
Okay.
Like scholars do with any ancient text.
Right.
And that led to questions about authorship, dates, even the historical accuracy of certain stories.
Yeah, I can see how that would cause problems.
Oh, yeah. Especially for those who believed in the divine, perfect nature of Scripture.
Exactly. Creates a lot of tension there.
So you've got all this intellectual upheaval happening, and then the fourth force, the challenge of Roman Catholicism to Protestantism in America.
Now, this wasn't just about disagreeing on a few theological points, right?
No, much bigger than that.
Okay.
The lecture highlights two big aspects here.
Okay.
First, a huge demographic shift.
Ah, right.
Mid-19th century Catholic immigration booms.
Yeah.
Cities that had been majority Protestant, like Boston, start seeing Catholic majorities.
Wow.
So that really challenged the existing Protestant dominance.
Yeah.
Their sense of cultural authority.
Makes you wonder if some of today's social and political anxieties are echoes of that, even if the specific religions are different now.
It's an interesting parallel for sure. And then, alongside the demographic shift, you have doctrinal differences.
The classic theological debates.
Big time.
Yeah.
Catholic doctrines like papal infallibility, the Immaculate Conception of Mary, those clashed head on with the Protestant emphasis on the Bible as the sole source of religious authority.
Right. Sola Scriptura.
Exactly. And the Protestant pushback often boiled down to, it's not in the Bible.
Simple as that.
Pretty much. And it's fascinating how the lecture jumps ahead to the 20th century, mentions the anxieties around John F. Kennedy's presidential run, him being Catholic.
Yeah.
Like, those old tensions were still very much alive.
Wow.
So you have this backdrop of intellectual change, social change, and now the question is, how did fundamentalism actually solidify its core beliefs?
Right. Good question. Where's the turning point?
This is where the summer Bible conferences come in.
Okay.
They were also called prophetic conferences a lot of the time.
Since of the focus on prophecy.
Exactly. Lots of emphasis on interpreting Old Testament prophecy.
Gotcha.
And they were crucial for conservative Protestants to come together.
Yeah.
Hash out what they considered the absolute essentials of Christian faith.
The non-negotiables.
Exactly. The lecture mentions Asbury Grove, which is near Gordon College, right, as an example of a place where these conferences still happen today.
So they weren't just a flash in the pan.
No, these conferences were vital for networking, for creating that consensus around key doctrines.
Yeah, like a platform for leaders to articulate and defend those essential truths.
Especially in the face of all these challenges we talked about.
Right, with all that pushback happening.
And it's out of these conferences that the five doctrines emerge.
Okay, the pillars of fundamentalism.
Exactly. The lecture really emphasizes how these became absolutely central.
The lines in the sand.
No doubt. So what were they, these core tenets?
First and foremost, inerrancy of the Bible.
Okay.
This is the belief that the Bible has no errors in its intended teachings.
Interesting.
And the lecture specifically contrasts this with the Catholic idea of papal infallibility.
So highlighting that difference in authority.
Yeah.
Protestants putting the Bible above everything else.
Right. So it's not about every single scientific or historical detail being literally true as we understand it today.
Not necessarily.
But that the Bible's core message, its teachings on faith and salvation, those are trustworthy.
Reliable, authoritative.
Absolutely. Second core doctrine was the virgin birth of Jesus.
Okay, yeah.
A direct rejection of those who were starting to see Jesus as just a good human being.
Right.
It affirmed his divine nature, that he was more than just a man.
Third, the substitutionary atonement.
Right.
This is the belief that Christ's death on the cross was a direct substitute for individual sinners.
Taking their place, paying the price.
Exactly. And the lecture really stresses how central this specific understanding was to fundamentalism.
Christ dying in their stead.
That's the key point. Fourth essential doctrine, the physical resurrection of Jesus from the dead.
Yeah, makes sense.
No ambiguity there. A complete rejection of the idea that Jesus' death was the end.
Right. Affirming the victory over death.
And that promise of future resurrection.
Right, right. Hope for the future.
Exactly. And finally, the fifth doctrine, the authenticity of the gospel narratives.
Okay.
This was a firm belief that the gospels were reliably written by who they said they were written by.
Yep.
And that they accurately depicted historical events.
So pushing back against those who question the authorship and dating of the gospel.
Exactly. Countering that higher criticism that was creating so much doubt. And the lecture makes a really important point here. These weren't just theoretical ideas they debated.
No, I bet not.
These became living doctrines. Mm. They shaped how fundamentalists preached, how they did missionary work, how they understood evangelism.
It affected everything they did.
Absolutely. Active, foundational beliefs that permeated their entire approach to faith.
It makes sense when you think about it. If you truly believe something that strongly,
yeah,
it's going to affect everything you do.
Right. It becomes a way of life.
So it wasn't just the five doctrines. There were other characteristics of the movement that helped it spread and grow.
Okay. Like what?
Well, one of the biggest was the founding of Bible schools, colleges, and seminaries.
Interesting.
Fundamentalists felt that the established universities,
aren't some ones with Christian roots?
Even those.
Yeah.
Places like Princeton, Yale, Harvard.
Wow.
They felt those institutions had strayed from their original mission.
Which was?
To train Christian leaders, uphold traditional doctrines.
Interesting. So in their view, these schools had failed their Christian purpose.
That's right. And so they started founding their own schools.
To ensure the next generation would be taught their beliefs.
Exactly. The lecture lists several examples. First, Moody Bible Institute.
Oh, yeah.
Founded by Dwight L. Moody himself in 1886.
So he was right there at the forefront of this trend.
Absolutely. Then there's BIOLA, the Bible Institute of Los Angeles, mm-hmm, founded in 1907. And Philadelphia College of the Bible, founded in 1914.
Wow.
Though it goes by a different name and is in a different location now.
Right.
It's incredible how quickly they built this network.
Yeah. A whole parallel system of education.
And speaking of which, the lecture also highlights Boston Missionary Training Institute.
Ah, yes.
Yeah.
Which became Gordon College.
Exactly. Founded in 1889. Shows how Gordon's beginnings are tied to this whole movement.
Makes sense.
And there's a Providence Bible Institute founded in 1900.
Okay.
Which became Barrington College and eventually merged with Gordon in 1985.
That's right.
The lecture even mentions Gordon's legal name, Gordon College. the United College of Gordon and Barrington.
For a reminder of that history.
Definitely. And then there's Fuller Theological Seminary, founded by people who were leaning towards evangelicalism.
Okay.
Shows that even within conservative Christianity, there were these different paths.
Right. Evolving identities. So alongside the schools, the summer Bible conferences continue to be important.
Or absolutely. Ongoing centers for teaching, theological development.
And for connecting fundamentalists from different places, different denominations.
For sure. There were also early adopters of media. Embracing radio and later television.
It's a smart move.
To spread their message far and wide.
Yeah, reaching a bigger audience.
They were also prolific in publishing.
Makes sense.
Tons of books, pamphlets, Sunday school materials.
Spreading their interpretations, their views on everything.
Reaching people on all fronts.
And of course, they kept up that strong commitment to foreign missions.
Oh, absolutely. Building on that 19th century momentum.
Global movement.
And then you have the rise of parachurch networks.
Okay.
These were organizations like Youth for Christ and InterVarsity.
I've heard of those.
Not tied to any specific denomination.
Interesting.
They brought together fundamentalists from all kinds of backgrounds to work on shared causes.
Like a unified front.
Yeah. Fostering that sense of unity and purpose.
Powerful stuff. So strong doctrines, effective organizations.
Yep.
Fundamentalism's really taking hold in American religious life.
It's becoming a force to be reckoned with.
But then the lecture shifts to this pivotal event that really shaped public perception.
The Scopes Trial.
Exactly.
The dramatic center of fundamentalism, as the lecture calls it.
1925, Dayton, Tennessee. Yeah,
it's when the movement takes center stage nationally.
In a big defining way.
For sure.
Now, the context for this trial was a Tennessee state law.
Okay.
It made it illegal for public school teachers to teach anything that denied the biblical account of creation or that suggested humans evolved from lower animals.
So basically banning the teaching of evolution.
Pretty much.
Bold move.
And John Scopes, a biology teacher in Dayton, he deliberately taught evolution in his classroom.
Oh, wow. A direct challenge.
Yep. And this leads to a legal challenge orchestrated by the ACLU.
The American Civil Liberties Union.
Right. They saw the Tennessee law as a violation of academic freedom.
Of course.
Separation of church and state.
Classic constitutional issues.
Big time. They wanted to test this law in court.
See if it would hold up.
And this thing blew up into a massive national event.
It's a huge story.
Huge. And you have these two giants facing off.
Who were they?
William Jennings Bryan.
Yeah.
Three-time presidential candidate, former Secretary of State.
Wow, big name.
He steps up to defend the Tennessee law.
Okay.
And on the other side, Clarence Darrow.
Ah, famous lawyer.
Brilliant, sharp, known for his liberal views.
Quite a contrast.
He was the lead attorney for the defense.
So you had these national figures descending on this small town.
Yeah, it was a media circus.
I bet. The lecture compares it to the O.J. Simpson trial.
Wow.
That level of public fascination, media attention.
It was everywhere. This wasn't just a local legal case.
No way.
It became this national spectacle, a battle of ideas.
Bryan, the fundamentalist, versus Darrow, the liberal.
Exactly. Though it's important to note, it wasn't a totally unified front among religious conservatives.
Oh, interesting.
The lecture mentioned some internal divisions there.
Like what?
Well, you had groups like Lutherans, Roman Catholics. Right. They actually supported Bryan's position against teaching evolution.
Interesting.
But some fundamentalists were hesitant to join forces with them.
Why is that?
Theological differences, mainly.
Oh, right.
Fundamentalists were very big on doctrinal purity.
Makes sense.
Even if it meant not presenting a united front on this moral cause.
Interesting. Putting their own beliefs first.
So what happened? What was the outcome of this huge publicized trial?
Well, the lecture argues that fundamentalism, in a way, won and lost at the same time.
How so?
The win was Scopes was found guilty.
Okay.
And the Tennessee Supreme Court later upheld the ban on teaching evolution. Mm. This is 1927.
Wow.
Though they did overturn Scopes' conviction on a technicality.
Oh, okay.
And sadly, Bryan, who'd become such a symbol of this fight, he died very shortly after the trial ended.
Oh, wow. Tragic.
It added this whole other layer to the event.
Yeah, a bittersweet victory for sure.
But the loss was more about public perception. Huh? The media, especially journalists like H.L. Mencken, they really painted fundamentalism in a negative light.
Backwards, unsophisticated, intellectually lacking.
Exactly. And Brian, in particular, was often mocked, portrayed as this simplistic figure.
So a PR disaster, basically.
Pretty much. And this negative image made things tough for fundamentalists.
Yeah.
It led some other conservative Christians, who actually agreed with many of their core beliefs,
yeah,
to distance themselves from the fundamentalist label.
Because it had become so toxic.
Exactly. But here's the crazy part. And the lecture really highlights this.
What's that?
Despite this public image of decline, intellectual defeat,
yeah,
the fundamentalist movement kept growing.
No kidding. So while everyone thought they were fading away after Scopes, they were actually thriving.
They were busy building an empire, as the lecture puts it.
Wow. How so?
Strengthening their Bible schools, publishing more, using radio and new media to spread their message.
Interesting. So working within their own networks.
Exactly. And their growth in the decades after the trial, the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s,
yeah,
it really surprised a lot of people.
They had underestimated them.
Big time.
And this brings us to what the lecture calls the central paradox of the movement.
Okay, let's hear it.
Fundamentalism's whole goal was to separate itself from modern culture, what they saw as its negative influences.
Yeah.
But ironically, they used the tools of that very culture, mm-hmm, print media, radio, later TV,
mm-hmm, to build and expand their own movement.
They flourished within the culture they were trying to avoid.
It's almost poetic.
It is, isn't it? A real twist of irony.
So the lecture concludes by saying, this fundamentalist movement, with its core beliefs and its strong organization,
yeah,
it paved the way for the rise of evangelicalism.
The movement many institutions, including Gordon, identify with today.
Exactly. Not a static thing, but a movement that kept evolving.
Reshaping the religious landscape.
So to recap our deep dive,
yeah,
we saw how figures like Moody and Gordon laid some groundwork.
Right.
We looked at the huge social, cultural, intellectual shifts that shaped the context for fundamentalism.
A perfect storm.
We talked about the summer Bible conferences, the five doctrines that became their core beliefs.
The foundations.
And we discussed how they built this movement, the schools, the media savvy, the missions work.
A powerful force.
And finally, that paradoxical impact of the Scopes trial.
Yeah.
Legal victory in some ways.
Right. But a public relations nightmare that ultimately shaped their image.
But they kept growing anyway.
Adapting, engaging with the very culture they often criticized.
It's fascinating.
It really is. And it makes you think, this movement, aiming to be separate, mm-hmm, was so deeply shaped by the culture it resisted, even using its tools to thrive.
It's a reminder that nothing exists in a vacuum.
Totally. What does this say about how ideas spread, how they take root?
Good question.
Sometimes in the most unexpected ways, it really makes you think about movements today, even those trying to be radical, different.
Yeah.
They often end up using the tools, the platforms of the mainstream.
Right.
Sometimes with consequences they never intended.
It's a fascinating case study, that's for sure.
Historical echoes that still resonate. Thanks for taking this deep dive with us.